gone to you, Nala. Never in my experience have you demonstrated such restraint and precision in your pyromantic attacks. I hypothesize that you may actually be maturing. It seems most unlikely, but I can come to no other conclusion at this time." Chandra scowled but said nothing. Instead, she took aim at Bon, who exhibited a slight smile as if to say, "Yes, that's the Chandra Nalar that I remember." 30 thopters flew into position between her and him, fast enough that Chandra didn't even bother to unleash her fire. And Dovan Bon was rocked by an explosion nevertheless. Knocked off balance, he stumbled, an expression of surprise appearing on a face unaccustomed to such emotions. Unnerved, he quickly realized the blast had detonated from below. He looked down off the side of the disc. Another Chandra Nalar, the real Chandra Nalar, was unleashing a massive torrent of flame just beneath the wall of hovering thopters. It was melting the base of the dais holding up the immortal sun, knocking it out of alignment and shaking the entire complex. Too late, Bon realized his mistake. He looked up, but the Chandra he had been so evenly mocking was gone, replaced by Demir Guildmaster and shapeshifter Lazav, using an Izzet flamethrower to complete the illusion. Before he could recalculate, Lazav unleashed not more flames, which Bon had been prepared for, but two small throwing stars of a peculiar metal that sliced through Dovan Bon's spells of protection and struck the Vedalken right in his eyes, throwing a serious crimp into his ability to detect weakness in others. Blinded and bleeding, Dovan Bon screamed. Hearing this from below, Chandra smiled a grim smile of satisfaction while silently thanking Nissa Ravain for her sage advice. She then used her fire to blow a wide path for herself through the wall of thopters. She rushed in, and with every ounce of her strength, strained to shove the immortal sun off its deformed dais. Azor's cursed artifact crashed onto the floor of the complex. She had hoped it would shatter, but no such luck. So following Jace's instructions, she moved in and stood upon it. Instantly, a power flowed through her. It galvanized Chandra, who briefly knew what it felt like to be a god. It took every ounce of will she had not to release a torrent of flame that would have incinerated all three towers, not to mention her friends. For a moment, she considered not turning off the sun.
"There's no reason to give this up. We can use this power. We can use it to defeat Bolas ourselves. And once the dragon is destroyed, we can take his place atop—" "No!"
Forcing her mind back into the moment, she spoke aloud the 9 words of Azor that Jace had taught her. The 9 words that would disable the sun. When practicing them earlier, they had sounded odd and unnatural in her mouth, but now they felt like her birthright. It frightened her. Fortunately, the words quickly worked their magic. Chandra felt her new untold power rapidly recede. As for the immortal sun, she could feel it lose its hold immediately. The lock had been sprung. She could planeswalk again. All the planeswalkers could planeswalk again. She wondered briefly just how many would. But Dovan wasn't quite done. He managed to clap his blood-soaked hands. The sound was both pathetic and sufficient, unleashing each and every one of his thopters in full attack mode. Yet all this really accomplished was to give the real Chandra the excuse to cut loose. And after what she'd just experienced, cutting loose seemed an almost necessary release. 2 intertwining bolts of fire emerged from her hands. Beneath her flaming hair and glowing eyes, she smiled as her twisting dual infernos sought out each and every one of Bon's thopters, and blew each and every one to kingdom come in a mighty conflagration that had Bon, Saheeli, Lazav, and Lavinia covering their faces. Faced with a defeat, one which he could not calculate even a percentage point's possibility of turning into a victory, Bon instead took advantage of the immortal sun being disabled and planeswalked away. When she saw him disappear in a sideways movement, Chandra lost her bright smile. Blind or not, Vaughn was still a threat that needed putting down. Still, her mission had been to snuff out the immortal sun. Mission accomplished. 45. Dak Faden. Returning from Amonkhet, Dak, Samut, Sarkon, and Karn had joined Gideon's assault on the Eternals. A minotaur named Angrath had lit up Hazaret's spear with flame, and together he and Karn were using it to incinerate more of Bolas's dreadhorde, three or four at a time. Samut spotted another minotaur, an eternalized minotaur, and hissed under her breath,
"How many times do I have to set you free, brother?"
They went at it. Dak moved to help, but the entire battle was over before he had figured out how he might assist. The minotaur was brutally strong, ripping up an entire paving stone to throw at Samut. But she was just too fast. In the blink of an eye, she was literally riding his back. Dak saw the minotaur reach back and knew that all it would take was a good grip on Samut for her spark to be lost. She crossed her two kopeshes in front of his neck and took his head, shouting,
"Once and for all, you are free, Neheb!"
Dak was so distracted by Samut's victory, he nearly got gripped himself. But Sarkon Vol transformed his own hands into mystic dragons, which breathed dragon fire, incinerating the two Eternals reaching for the thief. As the creatures burned, a planeswalker in white sliced off both their heads. She looked at Sarkon and said,
"Vol?"
He said,
"Wanderer."
Then they both looked disapprovingly at Dak before rejoining the battle. Dak looked down and shook his head, muttering,
"Pay attention, idiot."
He had once possessed a supremely powerful mystic gauntlet that had even helped him fight off a kraken. He'd had to trade the artifact to cure a sleeping curse and hadn't even gotten a Xeno out of the deal. As he took up the fight again, he wished nothing more than to have that gauntlet back on his hand. Yet, despite his reservations, Dak had to admit that Gideon's strategy was working. The Eternals, even the God Eternals, were being driven back toward the citadel of Bolas. And that's when it happened. As soon as he had returned to Ravnica, Dak had sensed the oppressive magic that prevented him from planeswalking away. Part of him was glad. He wanted to be brave, wanted to be the kind of man who stayed and fought. And thanks to the immortal sun, there had been no choice in the matter. But suddenly he felt it. The pyromancer's mission to shut the sun down had clearly succeeded. Dak knew he could leave at any time. And all around him, he saw other planeswalkers doing just that. In fact, so many did just that, the assault began to falter. The Eternals pushed back. The God Eternals advanced again, and from above, Gideon, riding a Boros Pegasus, ordered a retreat. Dak was sorely tempted to depart this world right then.
"I mean, I'm just a thief. Who am I to stay when others flee? And we're not just talking about evil bastards like Obnixilus now. Plenty of others are going while the going is good. Why not Dak Faden?"
Just then he spotted the Wanderer trapped between two Eternals. She did the smart thing and planeswalked away, only to planeswalk right back behind her opponents and quickly dispatch both with one swing of her sword. Dak was pretty impressed. Planeswalking was draining on a good day, but on a day like today, planeswalking twice, back and forth, within a matter of seconds, was a feat he flat out couldn't accomplish no matter how gods be damned rested he was. Still, Dak took heart at this. What the Wanderer had done suited him.
"If I get in a jam, I can bug out, and then bug back in soon after. Maybe not 2 seconds later after, but eventually. Or not. If I get in a jam, I can bug out and decide then whether I'm coming back. But right now, I stay and fight."
Because ultimately, Dak Faden refused to be one of those planeswalkers, the kind that runs when things get tough. Maybe he was just a thief and not any kind of hero. Nevertheless, he'd be the kind of thief who chooses to stay. 46. Kaya.
The first juggler, wearing studded red leathers and ribbons that ended in sharp metal fishhooks, impressively juggled 6 flaming torches. The second juggler juggled 8 human skulls. The third juggled 12 flaming skulls. The fourth juggler was an undead skeleton, bones reinforced with wrought iron, including 4 wrought iron horns mimicking those of its master, Rakdos the Defiler. It juggled flaming cat skulls pulled from a small furnace smoldering within its own rib cage. Without warning, the skeleton flung one of these small burning skulls at Teo, who barely managed to throw up a circular shield of white light to block it from hitting him in the eye. The skull ricocheted off his shield and struck the skeleton in the face. It laughed a hoarse, airless laugh, and Teo shivered. Kaya tried to reassure him.
They're just trying to intimidate you.
Teo looked at the ground and grumbled, "It's working." The skeleton whispered,
"You've got us all wrong, mistress. We're just trying to entertain you."
Teo glared at the skeleton and grumbled, "It's not working." The skeleton laughed again and said,
"Well, at least you're entertaining me."
They were descending the 500 steep steps of the demon's vestibule toward Rix Mahdi, guild hall of the cult of Rakdos. Veins of lava running down the worm-carved walls shed a dull red light across all they could see. Another performer was perched on every 4th or 5th step. After the jugglers came the puppeteers, each with a marionette designed to bring nightmares. The last of these made Rat gasp aloud. At first, Kaya thought the young girl was afraid. She had been uncharacteristically silent throughout their descent. But upon seeing that the marionette was a brutally accurate caricature of the Razor Witch Hikara, complete with actual razors, Kaya quickly realized that Rat's reticence didn't come from fear, but from grief. Rat smiled sadly at Kaya and whispered,
"It won't be the same here without her."
Hikara's passing was exactly why Kaya had strongly suggested that the Gorgon accompany herself, Rao, Teo, and Rat to Rix Mahdi, and why Kaya had insisted Vraska come without her Crawl or erstwhile defenders. If the cultists wanted an explanation or demanded vengeance for the death of Emissary Hikara, Ral and Kaya wanted Vraska there to explicate or to pay the price. Surprisingly, the Gorgon had not objected. Seemingly of its own volition, the Hikara puppet threw very real razors at Rao, Zarek, and Vraska. The small blades weren't thrown with quite enough force to cause any serious damage to either the Izzet or Golgari guildmasters, though Rao was left with a small cut on his arm, and Vraska's face had been nicked and was slowly dripping a line of blood down her cheek. Kaya briefly worried whether or not those razors had been coated with poison. But Rat read her concern and shook her head.
"They're clean, but they might not be on the way back up the stairs," she said, "depending on how this goes."
Puppeteers gave way to caged horrors with masked devils seated atop the cages, ready and willing to set the little monsters free. These particular horrors, spidery things that huffed and puffed and screeched and wailed, were only the size of raccoons. But then again, on this tight, claustrophobic staircase, a raccoon-sized horror would be quite sufficient to do significant damage to any or all of their party. The devils giggled wildly and constantly motioned toward their latches, threatening to open their cages. Teo flinched every time, which only encouraged the behavior. The walls were lined, smeared, with hundreds of torn and overlapping banners, some advertising centuries-old performances, most incorporating some insult to one of the other guilds, with Orzhov, Azorius, and Boros being the most common or popular targets. Kaya stopped to stare at one banner that appeared as ancient as any, but depicted herself, Ral, Vraska, and Lavinia hanging like marionettes, each from a single string wrapped tightly around their throats. Their heads lolled, their tongues stuck out, their limbs were slack, their faces bloated and blue. The puppeteer holding their 4 noose-like strings was a painted image of the Hikara marionette, and the puppeteer working Hikara's strings was the Defiler himself.
It didn't bode well for their reception below. Kaya inhaled, exhaled, and moved on, glancing back over her shoulder to see Teo stop for a look too. Kaya thought he was developing a tick in his left cheek. Rat took some notice and ushered him forward, saying,
"At least they don't have a banner of you."
"Yet," he amended nervously. Past the devils and their horrors were the fire breathers. Teo motioned to create a shield, but Rat arrested his hand and shook her head.
"You'll only encourage them. Just pay attention, and when they inhale, pass them by."
Throughout their descent, Ral and Vraska remained wary but stoic, each brooding deeply on his or her own dark thoughts, most of which likely revolved around Hikara. Except for Teo, who hadn't known her, they were all mourning the Razor Witch to some degree. She had been the unlikely glue that had held this group of unlikely friends together. When Vraska betrayed them, and Hikara died as an almost direct result, the friendship had disintegrated. Even Kaya and Ral, who had done nothing to each other and had no reason for mutual mistrust, felt Hikara's loss looming between them. In part, this was because Ral had held himself aloof from Hikara, taking advantage of her without ever truly acknowledging her as someone he cared about, though of course, after it was too late, he realized he cared about her deeply. Kaya knew he felt guilty over this failing, and she surmised that a part, an irrational part of Zarek, was angry with her for having openly treated Hikara with warmth and fellowship. Mostly, however, he was simply angry with himself.
"And worried about Tomik," Rat added.
"Rat is definitely a little bit psychic. And yes, of course, Ral's worried for Tomik. He's been missing ever since Bolas arrived. Ral must be going crazy."
Kaya tried to offer Ral a look of sympathy, but his eyes never quite focused on her enough to see it. The deeper they went, the hotter and closer the air became, and not just because of the fire breathers. The red veins in the curving walls were wider down here and more liquid. The searing lava dripped down onto the steps and needed to be carefully avoided if one wanted to keep one's boots intact, or one's feet. The fire breathers now gave way to unicyclists, who balanced impressively in place, rolling back and forth within the span of a few inches, on devices that appeared designed for a torture chamber. Spokes of barbed wire, clawed wheels, seats made from axe blades. More than one of the riders bled. Every rider came close to slicing gashes in their party of five. One cyclist, who clearly couldn't even see Rat, nearly chopped off her foot. But this sort of near catastrophe seemed to be a common occurrence for Arathia Shakta. The girl had trained herself to be preternaturally aware of her surroundings at all times and easily skipped past the threat. Finally, they reached the bottom step, and the vestibule terminated at the festival grounds, which were guarded by two immense ogres wearing masks made from actual ogre skulls. Kaya hesitated, but the ogres ignored them all, as if all five of them were rats, so she ignored them back and continued forward across the large courtyard. In its center was a cracked and graffitied fountain featuring a statue of a centaur. From a certain angle, the statue was surprisingly elegant, but as Kaya approached, she saw that chunks of marble had been broken off the man-horse as if by a sledgehammer. Water dribbled from broken lips, and that water in turn dribbled out of the cracked fountain and down through a crack in the floor, where it rose again as steam. Above them, unoccupied trapeze swings hung from rusty hooks, while a single young pigtailed tightrope walker in a black and red harlequin leotard glided heedlessly across a threadbare strand. Her movements were full of grace, drawing the eye. She glanced down at her new audience, and Teo gasped. Her lips and eyelids had been stitched shut. There were empty cages large enough to hold human horrors. And everything, absolutely everything, was haphazardly painted with splatters of what Kaya had to assume was actual blood. At the far end of the festival grounds, two more skull-masked ogres stood guard before the ornate stone facade of Rix Madi. Like the first pair, These ogres seemed to take no notice of Kaya and the others. Still, their little group hesitated before the entrance's ominous red glow, until Vraska muttered, "Screw it," and marched through the arched gothic doorway. Ral and Kaya exchanged a glance and followed, with Rat and Teo close behind. Rix Mahdi's facade was literally that. Within was no architecture, just a massive natural volcanic cavern. Steam rose from a huge central lava pit, as big as Lake Keru on Kaya's homeworld, and was vented above by natural chimneys that presumably ran all the way up to Ravnica's surface. They were all sweating profusely now, even Teo, the desert dweller. He shrugged and said, "It's not the heat, it's the humidity." Stone causeways crisscrossed the lava pit. Steel cables crisscrossed the ceiling, supporting more rusty cages and hooks. Blood-filled basins dotted the landscape. So did dozing hellhounds. The walls were pockmarked with dozens of doors to dozens of chambers. Laughter emanated from some, screams from others, both from many. To their left, at ground level, a large aperture in the wall was shrouded by a supernatural mist of pure shadow. A foul breeze wafted forth from within. Something about it gave even the ghost assassin the shivers. Rat slid up to Kaya and whispered, "Where is everybody? Rix Mahdi is usually packed with performers. I've never seen it so empty." Kaya looked through the red-tinged gloom. Except for the hellhounds and the occasional scurrying rat, there wasn't a soul around, living or dead, except the five members of their party. Then, as if on cue, a startling figure appeared in a burst of red smoke.
"Dame Exava,"
Rat whispered.
"Blood Witch, she's the Defiler's current number two."
As the smoke slowly cleared, Exava came into focus. She was tall, muscular, and apparently human. She wore an immense and elaborate mask decorated with two sets of what were probably genuine demon horns. A tight bodice accentuated a large chest and a bare midriff. She wore thigh-high boots and a wide belt from which hung numerous iron spikes, all red-stained, again, presumably with blood. She stood upon a small stage and, unaware of Rat, stared down at the other four with imperious contempt. Kaya, Ral, and Vraska looked at one another and then bowed their heads in unison. Ral spoke the formalities. "We honor you, Exava, as a blood witch of rare talent, and we beg an audience with your master, the Defiler." Exava studied them in silence. Then she looked toward the pit. Lava bubbled, but nothing else appeared, including the demon.
"Apparently," Exava said in a rich contralto, "the Defiler begs no audience from you."
But in that moment, Rakdos's booming voice echoed throughout the entire cavern.
"Where is our emissary?"
Rao glared at Vraska, who stepped forward, ready to take whatever was coming to her. But before she could speak, a voice called out, "She is here!" They all turned toward the main entrance. It was Tomek Vrona, leading a single Orzhov thrall, which carried a covered corpse. Tomek signaled the thrall, which stopped. He uncovered the corpse's face. "I have brought Hikara back to her people." They all saw Ral rush over to Tomek, but only Kaya and Teo saw Rat scurry over to Hikara's side. She stood on tiptoe to see her friend and kissed Hikara on her pale cheek. Ral stopped short of kissing Tomek, though Kaya knew he clearly wanted to. At which point, Exava cleared her throat impatiently. All eyes turned to face her. She said,
"Have your creature place the Razor Witch on the stage at my feet."
Tomek gestured, and the thrall complied. Exava knelt beside Hikara's corpse and jerked the shroud that covered her away. She flung it into the air, and it burst into flames dramatically, over-dramatically. Its ashes rained down on the thrall, Tomek, and the rest. The Blood Witch ran a hand from the top of Hikara's head all the way down to the tips of her painted toes in a disturbingly erotic caress. She said,
"You should have brought her back sooner."
"Apologies," Tomek said with a bow. "Things have been a bit chaotic up on the surface."
"That is not the cult's concern."
"But it should be," Rao stated. Exava rose, snapping her fingers dismissively. Or so it seemed at first. But within seconds, six more blood witches appeared in six more puffs of red smoke. They came prepared and quickly stripped Hikara's body naked, much to Teo's obvious embarrassment, and then adorned it in rags and bells. When the process was completed, Exava said,
"Have your thrall take Hikara into the jester's crypt."
She pointed a long, elegant finger toward the noxious aperture. Tomek made two more hand gestures, and the thrall took up the corpse. With Hikara in his arms, the creature trod dully through the aperture, flanked by a procession of the six witches. Rat said,
"I hope Mr. Vrona didn't like that thrall. He won't see him again."
And again on cue, they all froze at the sound of the thrall's blood-curdling death scream. Tomek looked absolutely horrified. Rat shrugged. Exava said,
"I will return shortly. Stay here."
She then burst into flame, much as Hikara's shroud had. Ashes rained down, but not one of their number actually thought Exava had burned. Rao then grabbed Tomek by the shoulders and growled,
"I've been looking all over for you."
Tomek smiled at his partner and gently leaned his forehead against Rao's. They both just stood there breathing for a few moments. Then Tomek leaned away, shrugged, and said,
"You have had your duties. I have had my own."
Rao took a step back.
"Which are what, exactly?"
Tomek answered Rao, but looked past him at Kaya.
"I am the executive assistant to the true guildmaster of the Orzhov. For years, I believed that to be Tesa Karlov. Now I know it is Kaya. And so I have been about the business of serving my mistress."
Kaya smiled at Tomek and thanked him. Then the epiphany hit.
"Tomek, you're the one who actually rallied the Orzhov troops into battle."
"That was mostly the giant Bilagru. You made a good impression on him."
"After you sent him to me and primed the pump."
Tomek tilted his left hand as if to say, "Such is my duty." Just then, Exava emerged from the jester's crypt. She was dressed the same, except now she wore bright red gloves. Kaya swallowed.
"No, those aren't gloves. Gloves don't drip."
Vraska stepped forward again.
"Great and talented Exava, Ravnica requires your aid. If Hikara were alive, she'd urge you to help us convince your master."
Exava interrupted.
"Emissary Hikara died because she placed her trust in you three."
She pointed from Vraska to Rao to Kaya.
"One of you betrayed her, one of you denied her, and one of you simply failed her."
"All true,"
Rao said with evident remorse, but no little determination.
"And there are no guarantees now, save this. If the 10 guilds do not unite, Ravnica is surely doomed."
"Then the cult of Rakdos will dance on Ravnica's grave. We're quite good at grave dancing. It's a specialty."
"I'm sure you are, and I'm sure it is," Rao said. "But the dead can't dance."
"You'd be surprised."
"Please, listen. Niv-Mizzet left us one last plan to defeat Nicol Bolas. If you allow me to explain..."
"We already know every detail of the late Firemind's latest grasp at power,"
echoed Rakdos's voice.
"We'll have none of it."
Exava smiled dangerously.
"I think you should go," she said.
"But
before you really piss him off."
Rao, Tomek, Vraska, and Kaya all looked inward, studying to see if there was anything they could do or say that might make a difference. But in the end, their shoulders all collectively sank, and they turned to go. Kaya saw Teo turn to Rat and say,
"That's it?
We're giving up?
But Rat wasn't listening. She was focused on the opening of the Jester's Crypt. Kaya followed her look and gasped.
What's your hurry, partners?
Hekara said, emerging from the shadowy space.
Ral, Vraska, and Tomik were halfway to the exit. They stopped in their tracks and turned.
Hekara? Ral said stupidly.
Well, yeah, she said with a shrug. Weren't you dead?
Vraska said just as stupidly.
Well, sure. Miss me?
More than you can know, my friend, Ral said.
The admission seemed to cause him some discomfort, but he got through it.
Stop it,
Hekara said.
You'll embarrass me.
Just kidding. I never get embarrassed. Be as mushy as you want. It's horrible theater, but we all have our guilty pleasures, right?
Vraska, even more pained than Ral, said, I owe you an apology, Hekara. I never should have betrayed your trust.
It was a pretty crappy thing to do, and dying sucked. But hey, it all worked out. After all, you can't be resurrected as a blood witch if you don't die first, right?
You're a blood witch now?
Rat asked in some awe. But Ral couldn't hear Rat and spoke over her, asking,
Can you convince Rakdos to join Operation Desperation?
Ooh, good title,
the new blood witch said.
Anyway, don't sweat it. I'll represent the cult in whatever you got planned, mate.
No, you will not, Exava boomed. The Defiler has made his wishes clear.
Really? 'Cause he hasn't said word one to me.
At the time, you were dead, and thus a somewhat inattentive audience.
He could set me straight now.
There's no need. I'm doing that.
But you're not the boss. Not the boss of me, anyway. You're just a blood witch. And since I'm a blood witch now, too, I'm thinking I don't need to follow your orders. You don't outrank me anymore, Exava. You just kinda side-rank me.
Witch, I'll kill you all over again!
Exava leapt, her bloody hands reaching for Hekara's throat. Hekara cartwheeled away. The cartwheel morphed into a somersault, which morphed into a backflip. Hekara landed on the stage. Once she had the high ground, she materialized multiple razors in both hands and threw them all simultaneously.
Once a razor witch, always a razor witch.
Exava was caught unprepared. She parried most of the blades with a wave of her hand, but more than one pierced her skin. It hardly slowed her down, but Hekara wasn't exactly in this fight alone. Ral fired up his accumulator and fired off a relatively small bolt that caught Exava from behind. She screamed and dropped to her knees. One of the hellhounds reacted, springing up to defend its mistress, but Hekara intercepted the brute, saying,
Stop it, Whipsaw! Sit!
The hellhound stopped, but did not sit. It growled menacingly, its mouth dripping an acidic saliva that sizzled when it hit the ground. Ral recharged, ready to fry the beast. Hekara waved him off, but didn't even bother to look his way. She just kept speaking soothingly to the hellhound.
Don't mind Ral, he's okay, and Exava will be her old diva self in no time. Now sit.
The beast sat. Hekara called out to the still absent Rakdos.
I'm going to help my mates now. You don't mind, do you, boss?
The defiler remained silent.
Okay, then, Hekara said with a laugh. Let's get on with it.
She led the way out, and Tomik, Vraska, and Ral followed. But Kaya and Teo saw Hekara walk right by an expectant Rat, without noticing her at all. Rat's face fell. She looked away. All three of them knew instantly. Whatever process had brought Hekara back to life had changed her enough so that she could no longer see Rat. And that broke the young girl's heart. 47. Jace Beleren. Jace told himself she'd left them all with no choice. He reminded himself, as if to prove the point, that even Chandra, even Gideon, had not tried to stop him, no matter how unhappy the notion made them. that Jaya Ballard and Teferi, who both knew and liked the necromancer well enough, had agreed to help. He insisted to himself that this was not about his own history with the woman, not the bad or the good of it, that it had nothing to do with his supposed bias against her, his weeks and weeks of telling everyone how untrustworthy she was. No, the decision came down to two simple facts. One, the Eternals were murdering everyone they could get their hands on, planeswalkers and innocent civilians alike, and two, she controlled the Eternals. It was for those two reasons, and those two reasons alone, that Jace Beleren had forced himself to plan the assassination of Liliana Vess. And it was killing him. His time on Ixalan with Vraska had taught Jace many things. Vraska was a pirate, an assassin, and a collaborator with Bolas, and yet their burgeoning relationship had demonstrated in stark terms how unhealthy his liaison with Liliana had been. She had used him every chance she had. Used him for his powers, for his connections, for sex. She had twisted him around her little finger. He was too old to be her puppy dog, but looking back on those days and nights, he knew that's exactly how he had behaved, because that's exactly how she wanted it. She had toyed with him, leading him on, pushing him off, drawing him close, cutting him to the quick, playing to his vanity, making him feel like crap. Even, once or twice, making him feel like a god. Maybe at the beginning he could have walked away with no problem, but by the time she was done with all that elastic rigmarole, he was as hooked on her as any addict. It had taken a severe, if temporary, case of amnesia and the consistent warmth of a gorgon to get Jace to kick the habit. And still... Yes, damn it, there is more to Liliana than that. He had to believe there was. Of course, she's attractive, ridiculously, seductively, entrancingly, mysteriously attractive. But he hadn't been that desperate, had he? Somewhere buried deep inside her, okay, entombed might be the better word, Liliana Vess must have cared for him. At least a little. Right? Right? And he must have seen, beneath her impressive defensive shields of selfishness, self-interest, and sex appeal, that she had the potential for good at her core. Just because she hadn't lived up to that potential, had in fact betrayed it and him and the Gatewatch entirely, didn't mean that potential hadn't been there. And if it was there, it might still be there. And if it was still there, how could he kill her and rob her of any chance at redemption? Well, the fact that she was trying to harvest every single planeswalker, with no obvious exemptions being granted to Jace, or Chandra, or Gideon, or any of her friends, helped justify it, of course. But it wasn't just about his life or even the lives of his friends. She was committing genocide on Ravnica. Genocide on the planeswalkers. She had promised to help them defeat Bolas, and instead, she was using the powers and freedom that the Gatewatch had helped grant her in order to murder a world and its people and the planeswalkers for the dragon, though she knew what the dragon was and what he would do with the power she was helping him acquire. If I thought I could risk trying to talk to her, trying to reason with her. But they were past that point. She had seen what Bolas had done on Amonkhet, the devastation and loss of life, and had sided with him nevertheless. She had made her choice. She must be beyond anything resembling reason. Thus, she had to die. Vivian Reed was the only member of their little squad to object to the plan, and only because she hated Bolas, who had destroyed her homeworld. She would have much preferred an attempt on his life instead. The rest agreed, however, that they didn't have the necessary power to kill the dragon from a distance. No, ending Nicol Bolas would ultimately be up to Gideon and Blackblade at close range. But Gideon's path would have to be cleared first, and that meant taking out Liliana Vess. Jace's plan called for the four of them, Jace, Teferi, Jaya, Vivian, to perch on the roofs of four separate buildings equidistant on four sides from the citadel where Liliana stood, serving Nicol Bolas and controlling his deadly army. The timing of the thing had to be precisely coordinated, which was Jace's job. He had linked all four psychically while simultaneously making sure that psychic noise, specifically the psychic screams of the dying, drowned out their communication, preventing the dragon from reading them. Next came Teferi, who, on Jace's signal, cast a spell to slow down time for Liliana, who would now move and, more importantly, react in slow motion to their attacks. Jaya fired first, a precision pyromantic strike. A thin blade of flame to burn a hole in Liliana's chest. Jace doubted whether or not Liliana ever saw it coming. She didn't have to. Faces, indistinct and semi-transparent but with mouths open wide in silent screams, emerged from the chain veil and just barely managed to deflect Jaya's strike. The fire ricocheted off their lightless mana and splashed against the pyramid stones. These ghostly emanations, Jace knew, were the Onaki spirits that possessed the veil and had designs on the necromancer as well. But these spirits had never operated this way before. Liliana had never allowed it. Jace scowled, concluding that Bolas's hold over Liliana had somehow freed her to release the true power of the veil. From behind Vess, Vivian fired a single arrow from her arcbow. Jace found himself hoping the arrow itself might take Liliana's life, quickly and perhaps painlessly. Another of the Onaki, however, deflected the arrow from its host. Yet the arrow was never the true threat. Striking the citadel, the arrow unleashed a spirit of its own, a Scala wolf that leapt past and through the Onaki and ripped into Liliana's left arm, mauling her badly. The Onaki regathered and attempted to hold the wolf spirit at bay, giving both Jaya and Vivian the opportunity to try again. The Onaki blocked most of these attacks, but thanks to Teferi, the assaults seemed to be coming faster and faster, with more than a few getting by the spirits and doing significant, though not yet mortal, damage. Liliana was burned. Liliana was pierced. Liliana was torn. Liliana was failing. Jace stifled the urge to save her. With a slight wave of her good right arm, she sacrificed multiple flying eternals, throwing their bodies into the paths of flame, arrow, and spirit beasts. By using the veil, she drained other eternals, applying the energies of their unholy resurrections toward healing her wounds almost as she was receiving them. But Jaya and Vivian were relentless, and the slowed-down thoughts and defenses of Vess and the Onaki couldn't keep pace with the offensive. Liliana was vulnerable, and Jace knew they'd never have a better shot. And though a voice in his head was practically begging him to stop the others and terminate her torment, he knew the torments of Ravnica outweighed whatever Liliana was suffering. Best to end it. So far, Jace hadn't participated directly. Am I trying to avoid guilt by being only a passive participant? No. This is my plan. I'm responsible for it. So stop pretending otherwise. He fired off his own shot, a psychic attack that grabbed Liliana's attention and held it as Ballard and Reed took two more shots each. He heard her moment of recognition from within her mind.
Jace? Jace, please.
Jaya's flames burned the skin off Liliana's chest, though the Onaki circumvented any damage that was anything worse than skin deep. Vivian's next arrow sank deep into Liliana's shoulder. A Scala spider emerged from it and sank its fangs into her neck. Through it all, her mental screams echoed inside Jace's head. But he held her fast, kept her from calling either the Eternals or Bolas himself to her aid. She was trying to tell Jace something through the pain, but he would hear no more of her manipulations.
It's working, damn it.
She dropped to one knee. They almost had her, until Bolas's perhaps inevitable intervention. The dragon had been distracted by the flying sparks that were soaring toward him and arcing into his spirit gem. He was looking skyward, not down at his minion Vess. But fire enough arrows and flame streams in the vicinity of Nicol Bolas, even at his most self-involved, and he was bound to notice eventually. And it seemed he still had a use for Liliana Vess. The near-godlike dragon fired off four of his own magical blasts. Each collapsed one of the four buildings upon which the four assassins were standing. Jace felt the roof crumble beneath his feet. Thankfully, with great effort, Teferi was able, one after the other, to make each building collapse in slow motion. Jace leapt from one piece of slow-falling masonry to another, as if using stepping stones to carefully cross a river. He touched down on the ground and ran clear, reaching out with his mind. The other three had also made it out alive and unscathed. But when Jace looked up, he saw that Vess lived too. He could see the Onaki drive away the last of the dissipating Arkbow spirit animals. He could see Vess absorb the energy of more Eternals to heal herself. He could see Bolas smile his mirthless smile and turn away, spectacularly untroubled by the efforts of Jace and his allies. Now that the dragon was alerted, there would be no second opportunity. All they could do was retreat. They had failed. And a substantial part of Jace Beleren was glad. 48. Liliana Vess. It hurt. She had been singed by Jaya's flames, the blackened skin peeling away from muscle and fat tissue. There was an arrow sticking out of her right shoulder blade, and those damn beasts had badly mauled her left arm and right leg, and taken a substantial chunk out of her neck, just barely missing any major veins or arteries. She was on her knees, breathing in ragged gasps. She glanced up at Bolas, who had saved her life. He paid her no mind now. Though Liliana was certain the dragon had the power, healing his minion was clearly beneath him, or in any case, something with which he simply could not be bothered. The Onaki called to her in unsubtle whispers,
"Release yourself, vessel. Release yourself to us."
She ignored them, reaching past their offer to summon the power of the veil directly. With it, she drained the animus from two nearby Eternals. They practically melted before her. Lazotep coatings clinked against Citadel stone, but the bodies contained within were soon rigid with morbidity, splayed in ragdoll poses. She used their energy as a healing force, repairing her neck first, since it seemed to pose the biggest threat, and her chest second, since the burn caused the most pain. Though, of course, the moment that skin healed over, the pain from her leg and arm became almost as excruciating. She was forced to summon two more Eternals and forced to wait as they made their excruciatingly slow progress up the Citadel steps to come within range. Then she drained them, too, to heal her mauled limbs. Pulling the arrow out of her shoulder was almost an afterthought. She screamed as she tore the barbed point free and collapsed onto her side in a puddle of her own blood. She began shivering uncontrollably. She couldn't focus her vision, let alone her power, to find, let alone summon, another Eternal. But blood was blood. She managed to extend her hand and lick a few drops off her fingers. It was humiliating. But it was sufficient. Her necromantic power coalesced within the coagulating blood. Defying gravity, it poured upward, running up her arm to her shoulder. Soon the stones were clean, and her wound was healing. She allowed herself to remain prone for a few more seconds, then slowly, tenderly, cautiously, began to rise. Still breathing hard, she made an attempt to regain her dignity. A simple spell cleaned her face. Another repaired and cleaned her black dress. She removed the chain veil to silence its whispers, at least temporarily. She was exhausted, but she was herself again. Liliana Vess again. But it still hurt. Every inch of her felt tender and sore, Every nerve felt exposed and raw. But what hurt more than her physical injuries was the echo of Jace Beleren within her mind.
He tried to kill me. Not to reach me. Not to stop me. Not to convince me to stop. Not even to render me unconscious. He just wanted me dead.
Of course, a part of her was hardly surprised.
Why should I expect mercy or understanding from my so-called friends? And for just that reason, why should I have any mercy on them?
And yet another part of her had to admit that Jace and the others had little choice if they wanted to stop the carnage.
Bolas left me with no choice, and I in turn left them with none.
A third part, buried deep, believed she deserved death. What kind of life will be left to me when all this is over? And will it ever be over? Or will I spend eternity as Bolas's pawn and plaything? Maybe I should have let them kill me. And a last part, buried deeper still, shed a tear for the loss of a man she knew had once loved her, and whom maybe, just maybe, she had once loved too.
49. Teo Virata.
Teo had no role in the ceremony. He was just a fly on the wall, or what was left of the walls, since they were holding the rite in the ruins of the former embassy of the Guild Pact. Rat stood beside him, providing the play-by-play, like the caller at a game of Sand Devil, which is to say that much of what she related was either already known to him or dead obvious. But she helped to make the event more entertaining.
Operation Desperation, the Fire Mine's final plan, she said, requires all 10 guilds, the ley lines of Ravnica, the charred bones of Niv-Mizzet, and that thing.
She was pointing to a brass model of a dragon head, Niv-Mizzet's head, to be specific, being carried forward by the Izzet goblin Verivort.
It's called the Fire Mine's vessel, and will contain his spirit when summoned from wherever it's currently residing. Assuming this works, that is, and given the name of the plan, that could easily be too much to assume, you know?
Verivort gently placed the vessel atop Niv's blackened bones.
See, Plan A had been to give Master Niv-Mizzet the power to fight Bolas. That didn't work out, and you can see the end result. Plan B, as in Beacon, failed too. This is Plan C, I think, unless I've lost count. So over there, Master Zarek's consulting with Miss Rivain. Mr. Beleren says she's some kind of expert on ley lines, has a magical connection to them. So, Master Zarek's explaining what they need to accomplish.
Ral and Nissa Rivain were speaking too quietly for either Teo or Rat to make out the words. But when Ral fell silent, Rat did as well. Nissa then proceeded to study the problem for 6 long minutes, during which she remained completely motionless, resembling a painted statue more than a living being. During this interval, Verivort came over to stand beside Teo. Not seeing Rat, he would have bumped right into her, but the girl adeptly sidestepped over to Teo's other side. Finally, Nissa nodded, saying,
"It might be possible. The ley lines were disrupted by the planar bridge, but with the bridge gone, I believe I can repair them and help Ravnica reassert herself."
"Well, that's promising at least," Rat said with a grin. "Now all we have to do is wait for the rest of the guild representatives to gather."
Ral, Kaya, and Vraska were already present, though each of the three had been guildmaster for less than a month. Lavinia arrived next. Since Dovin Bahn had fled, she was now acting guildmaster of the Azoria Senate, a position she'd held for about 52 minutes. Hekara, recently resurrected blood witch and emissary of the cult of Rakdos, literally cartwheeled around the decimated chamber, bells tinkling from her costume's leather ribbons. Rat's violet eyes went wide.
"She's so cool."
Then her violet eyes saddened as Hekara cartwheeled right past her once again.
"Still," Teo noted, and not for the first time, "Rat's nothing if not resilient."
When Borborygmos, leader of the Gruul clans, arrived with Rat's parents, Ari and Gan Shakta, Rat's mother smiled at her daughter, pointing Rat out to Gan Shakta and the Cyclops. Both squinted at the space next to Teo until they could see the girl. Arathia Shakta's violet eyes lit up like two stars. "My mom's pretty cool, too," she said. Emara Tandris, champion of the Selesnya Conclave, arrived with Boruvo, who exchanged a few dangerous-sounding growls with his former Gruul clanmates, who seemed to regard him as a traitor for having switched guilds. Teo braced himself, ready to create a shield to prevent a fight. But a stern look from Rat chastened the centaur, the Cyclops, and her parents.
"Can't we all just get along?" she said.
They nodded without too much reluctance. Next came Vanifar, prime speaker of the Simic Combine, accompanied by Voril. Then Aurelia, guildmaster of the Boros Legion, flew in, still hot from battle. Only when all the others had shown their faces did Guildmaster Lazav of House Dimir reveal that he had been there all along, right beside Teo and Rat, by morphing out of the form of the goblin Verivort.
"Damn it, Lazav," Ral said in a clipped and dangerous voice. "What the hell have you done with the real Verivort?"
Lazav reassured Ral in a lazy drawl.
"Your accomplished chief chemister is sleeping one off. He'll be just fine come morning, assuming this succeeds, and any of us are just fine come morning."
Nissa looked uncomfortable, and Rat nudged Teo with her elbow. He stared at her, unsure of what she wanted.
"Help the elf," she whispered.
He nodded and stepped forward, saying, "If everyone would just gather around Miss Ravain?" Kaya approached, and Nissa silently indicated where she needed the Orzhov guildmaster to stand. This process was repeated in turn with Hekara, Ral, Lavinia, Lazav, Aurelia, Borborygmos, Vanifar, Vraska, and Emara. There was some grousing and considerable mistrust among the various guild representatives, with Lavinia and Vraska very nearly coming to blows when Nissa placed them next to each other. But Nissa finally opened her mouth and declared,
"Let me make this clear. Without a perfect act of unity from every single guild in concert, the plan has no hope of succeeding. You must put all grievances, petty or otherwise, behind you."
The act of saying that many words in sequence seemed to visibly exhaust the elf, but they did the trick. Soon enough, the 10 guild representatives were standing in a slightly warped circle around Nissa and the bones and vessel of the Firemind. The remaining few in attendance, Teo, Rat, Boruvo, Voril, Ari, and Gan Shakta, stood in something of a clump just outside the circle. Ari seemed to be looking Teo up and down. She frowned a little in a look reminiscent of those granted to the acolyte by Abbot Berez. Apparently, Teo Virata had not quite passed muster as a dependable friend to Ari Shakta's daughter.
"You stand upon the ancient ley lines of the Guild Pact," Nissa said, pulling Teo's attention back to the matter at hand.
"Which has exactly what to do with dragon bones?" Aurelia asked in a decidedly suspicious tone. The elf again looked uncomfortable, and Ral took a step forward before quickly stepping back when Nissa glared at him in frustration for leaving his designated spot. He said,
"We are here to resurrect the Firemind as the new living guild pact."
Apparently this was news to approximately half the guild leaders. Voril shouted, "What?" And Aurelia growled, "That's what this is?" more or less in concert. Borborygmos roared along with them both. Lavinia grumbled, "Didn't we try this already when he was alive? What makes you think—" Hekara said, "It's not called Operation Desperation for nothing, you know." Ral held up his hands and said, "We did try, and we failed. But the same terms apply. Jace Beleren has lost the power of the Living Guild Pact. We need that power to defeat Nicol Bolas. If we succeed here, Niv-Mizzet will rise again to that power and use it against the Elder Dragon. Then, the Firemind will step down as Guildmaster of the Izzet, and, as one of Ravnica's most ancient, wise, and venerable parents,
take up this new role as impartial arbiter to all 10 guilds and gateless alike. The gods know he can hardly do a worse job than Balerion.
Lavinia, Vraska, and Imara frowned at that last comment, but the rest seemed to begrudgingly acknowledge the truth of